going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices and give you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Joining me right now is Alan May. Love having Alan on. It's been a while, actually, since we've had Alan on. But the Caps just completed their best regular season in many years, finishing with the best overall record in the Eastern Conference. At Alan May underscore 16 on X on Twitter. Of course, Alan's been a part of the studio show and part of the booth with Joe B, especially when Locker was out. So good that Locker is back and healthy again at Monumental Sports. Alan's been a part of it forever now, it seems like. It's good to have you back. The season was a phenomenal one, but I want to start with something that I just mentioned, just the odds on the Caps making a deep Stanley Cup run. What do the odds makers know that others don't?
I would say what they're seeing is they're not willing to admit how wrong they were the way they forecasted the Caps just for the regular season.
Right.
When you look at it, most people had the Caps as a draft lottery team and not making the playoffs, and they're sticking to it. So, you know, I guess that's the easy way to do it, but you know, they were all so wrong. Everyone was wrong on how they picked the Caps to, you know, to do this season. And the Caps have just proved with the management team and the coaching staff they'd assembled that they made all the right choices in the offseason. And, you know, it panned out. They end up being the Eastern Conference leading team.
So you disagree with the odds makers. Tell me why you think they've got a chance to make a deep Stanley Cup run.
Well, the biggest thing, I just look at the body of work over the course of the season. I'm going to take that they clinched the playoffs basically 2 months ago.
Right.
And they were involved in every single game. I thought opening night was kind of a dud with them. I don't think they had the line assembled properly that night. And then right from game two, they went on and on and on. They were involved in every single game except maybe two until about the 60-game mark. Like actually every period. They had the most comebacks in the National Hockey League. They were never out of a game. They were always in. I think they were a little bit exhausted. And once they clinched, it's like they've got it. And basically, they had a 4-game winning streak about 15 games ago. And since then, you know, the record hasn't been that great. But then again, it's kind of like an in-season break that they were taking. And, you know, they took their foot off the pedal a little bit. And, you know, we've seen what happens when you win the President's Trophy over the course of a season. So I just think it's just a matter of, you know, they were so involved in every game, they're a little bit exhausted, and I expect them to come out firing in game one of the playoffs.
Do you think some of it was just everybody getting consumed with Ovi's chase?
You know, I actually discount that because that's all that people spoke about before the season. All the Capitals just going out there, and it was kind of a disservice and a disrespect from so many people around the National Hockey League as to Ovechkin being a selfish player, as to the Caps being a horrible roster. And I just think that at the end, because a little bit of fatigue, and it was mostly the big guys who they started to stumble in their numbers. But at the same time, you know, you had little nagging injuries pop up. When you're involved in every game, it's like being involved in every playoff game. There is a toll that it takes, but I've always believed it's better to have that lull when they had it versus right at the end and so exhausted and fatigued going into the first round of the playoffs that they got nothing left. And I would say that's what happened last year. They were so dialed in the last month to get in the playoffs that by the time the playoffs, that game one, they just had nothing left. And so I think that happened a lot sooner because they could allow it to happen sooner.
Yeah, Montreal kind of in the same position the Caps were in at the end of last year. We'll get to that in a moment. I haven't talked to you in a while. Alex Ovechkin, 44 goals in 65 games. It's very likely had he played close to a full season, he would have been the leading goal scorer in the NHL. Why was he so good this year?
I look at the roster around him, and he didn't have to do too much. And the way he was playing, I thought he was a more efficient. And even at the start of the year, there were so many back checks and defensive plays that he was making, and his legs hadn't looked that good in 5 or 6 years. So how he rested himself during the offseason, how he got himself ready during the offseason when he decided to start training, I don't think he was fatigued coming into the season. As you get older, it's harder to keep that playing weight. It's harder to keep your playing legs. And he just was so dialed in. And when he broke his leg, I think we'd be, well into the 900s right now in the goal scoring department. I really felt that the rate he was going, he was going to break that record in January. So I just feel like it was a commitment to the team for himself to be better, to be better in all areas, but they had such a better supporting cast this year, a team that was very, very big. At the start of the season, I believe they're the second largest team in the National Hockey League, and all the additions, with the exception of Andre Mangiapane, were 6'2 or greater. So I just think playing big guy hockey, it was easier for them to play and easier for him to play and not have to be counted on so much. And then you had the breakthrough season of a Protas breakthrough season by McMichael, and all these other players are 13 players that had career highs on the Capitals of their 18 regular skaters this year. That's astronomical. And I don't think a team has ever hit it with every trade and every free agent as the Caps did this offseason. So, once again, a way better roster. He didn't have to try to do too much. They didn't have to put him in a lot of situations that he shouldn't be in and, run him down of fatigue and wear him out. He could just focus on playing a positional game and just executing when called upon to score goals.
Do you sense heading into this postseason, it's been 7 years since the Cup. They haven't won a playoff series since winning the Cup. We know how much of a weight was lifted from his shoulders when they won it in Game 5 in Vegas back in 2018. You could just sense it with him, when that clock ran out and him screaming at the top of his lungs. Is there any pressure rebuilding on his shoulders to go deep and contend and maybe win another one?
I would say the pressure is internal for every player on the team, because those players that were here that won it and players that have won it anywhere, it's like a drug, and they want to feel that feeling again. And no one can explain the exhilaration of winning and what it does to your body with that surge of adrenaline. And they all want to get that feeling again. And, for someone that was doubted for so long in North America that he wanted to win, that there was so much Russian bias by old-time NHL people, and I've even heard it in the last month that where people didn't want him to break Gretzky's record because he was a Russian, and they were there were the people that, when the Russians used to come over, they were hell-bent on eliminating them from the ice. So I just think that he loves to win. He finally got a chance with a perfectly assembled team from management, coaching staff, and I feel like he's got the feeling, again, that he has that same type of team here. Now you've got to go up and prove it in the playoffs. But they all want to feel it. It never goes away. Every player wants to, any player that's ever been around winning wants to achieve that over and over.
All right, let's talk about this first-round matchup. How do they match up against Montreal?
Oh, I think it's a great matchup for the Washington Capitals. And the fact that they're a big team, and they're playing the youngest team ever in the National Hockey League class, according to something that I've heard in the last few days. They've got twice as much playoff experience. The Capitals are huge down the middle of the ice with their centermen. Dylan Strome, 6'3", Dubois, 6'4", Lars Eller, 6'2", 6'3". Nick Dowd, he's telling me 6'2", so I'm going to believe him. But when you And when you have that up and down the middle, you can take away the ice. Montreal likes to play a faster game, and they're depending on a very small young defenseman in Lane Hudson, who shattered all Montreal rookie records and a lot of NHL defenseman records with what he was able to do by putting numbers up this year. But to play without the puck against the younger team, they're going to force the Canadiens to play defense. And they've got a great goaltender, Samuel Montembeau, but I do not think that he is going to steal a series from the Capitals. And the Capitals, depending on where their health is, that's going to be the biggest factor. How healthy are they going into the playoffs? And once they set their mind to it, I think they can eliminate Montreal pretty quick using size, veteran accountability, and then forcing them to play in their own defensive zone, where in the last couple weeks, it's been Montreal on the press, Montreal on the press. They haven't played in their zone so well, and they open up a lot of high-danger opportunities. And I think analytically, the Caps are going to figure out how to play against them to create the offense inside the offensive zone and force Montreal into making mistake after mistake.
They haven't been back to the postseason since appearing in the finals during the COVID year. You just mentioned their goaltender. Just tell me that he's not the equivalent of like a Halak in 2010.
Well, it's a completely different team as well. So I look at the Halak thing, and I think a lot of the coaching at the time between the two teams, the drastic difference, and there was a defensive genius with Montreal, and they were countering on the Capitals a lot. And I didn't think the Caps played hard enough in front of Halak. He saw so many of the pucks. This Capitals team knows their best when they're creating goals from behind the goal line, where they're finding open players in the slot with one and then a second player joining at the net front. So they take away the vision of the goaltender. So 15 years ago, there was only one Montreal Canadian player from that team that's still in the National Hockey League, and that's Max Pacioretty, who's on the outside looking in right now. And a young John Carlson was around, but Alexander Ovechkin was basically the only Capital in that series. So 15 years ago, I don't think we're going to get Halak. I don't think we're going to get Montembeau.
Right.
And I just look at the drastically different teams that are put on the ice here.
All right. Speaking of goaltending, Logan Thompson missed the last 7 games. This is always important this time of year. Are you confident that he's healthy, ready to go, and that he can be, you know, a big-time factor in a run this time of year?
Well, impossible to answer right now because he has not been even on the bench yet. And there's a long time till the series actually starts.
Right.
You've got to get him in real practices. And, you know, you've got to be careful. You know, players, and I'm not saying this Logan's going to do this, but I know that I used to do it. I used to lie about my health at all times. And you've got to be very careful that when you put players back on the ice that they're 100%. I saw in the last little bit, one of the NHL teams had traded for some injured players, and they got them back in lineup, and they were hurt in the first period. So you got to err on the side of caution with the injuries. But with that being said, I really like the way Charlie Lindgren plays. The team has confidence in him. But so I look at it not being so goalie dependent. Neither of these two guys lets in funky goals. They stop what they're supposed to. They make big saves. But at the same time, the defenders in front have to dial down. So whether it's Logan or Charlie Lindgren starting in game one, the players have confidence in either one of these guys, and so do I. I think the biggest thing when LT gets back, he's got to be 100% healthy.
All right. It sounds like you really like them to get by Montreal. In the East, give me the matchup that you really don't want to see, if there is one.
Well, I'm not going to discount the Carolina Hurricanes, but I'd expect them to beat New Jersey. And I think the Capitals in a playoff series, if New Jersey were to win that, would be able to take them out handily using the size and everything we've spoken about. But Carolina, I think they'll stumbled onto something a few weeks ago, and that's they have to play them hard. And in the past, they played a little too much checkers with them, or chess, I should say. And I remember when they beat the Caps in 7, the Caps kept making the same mistakes over and over. And it was things that the coaching staff kept saying, do this, do this. And it was driving me crazy watching it. I thought the ground and pound game in front of their net and on their defenders is how you have to play them. Don't give them as much respect that they can do this and they can do that, so we have to do this defensively. And you can't really play your game on the heavy part of it. So I look at Carolina. But then when it gets later than that, the real thing is if they get out of the Metropolitan, then you've got to play, I think it's going to be Tampa or Toronto. And Toronto, to me, I picked them and the Caps all season long when both teams were healthy to meet in the Eastern Conference Finals. And it's not throwing shade at Tampa, who's got everything you want in a team, but there's something about the way the Toronto roster is constructed right now that it could be very hard to create offense. So if anyone is able to beat Tampa, they figured out how to get to the middle of the ice. And that's going to be bad news for anyone that plays that team.
Thanks for doing this. Hope you're well. Hope to see you soon. Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Alan May, Caps Canadians game one tonight. I'm going to finish up the show when we come back with a local receiver who could be a steal on day three.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today.
And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
Coverage all day here on the Team 980 leading up to Linnell and Toby's draft show from 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. Craig's going to take his show all the way up until 8 o'clock. Chris is on after me, and both of those gentlemen join me right now. It is one of those days where it's just interesting to see what everybody's thinking on draft day. It's different, guys, from it was a year ago when we pretty much knew at this point who it was going to be, which actually is where I'll start. Don't you think that this draft, given that they're taking the latest they've ever taken with their own pick ever in franchise history, because the last time they were this good, there were only 28 teams in the league. But don't you think in preparation for your shows to be able to talk draft even somewhat fluently, it is just so much deeper and more difficult because there are so many possibilities? Craig, you go first.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been way, way more difficult. Last year, I mean, really, we knew pretty early Jaden was probably the pick, but you just had to be prepared on Drake May, you know, J.J. McCarthy. You know, is there maybe one or two other guys that could come into it? Sure, but it was basically if you had a good file on those people, you were set. This year, I keep seeing new names. Now, like, all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, let me go look at Jahdae Barron a little bit more, because in his mock draft last night, Daniel Jeremiah's got Jahdae Barron falling all the way down.
Oh, really?
To 29.
Jeremiah had him?
Yeah.
Because that was my pick.
Yeah, like, I could see that. I'm trying to think of some of the other guys that, like, this week, you know, Omarion Hampton, like, could he be available? So there's kind of the non positions that we've talked about, also different guys at the edge spot. Like, I got to know seven different edges because all of them could be available. And it's not just Washington picking the slate. It is the contour of this draft class, and it's made it very difficult, but also very fun in its own way.
Yeah, Chris.
Yeah, I think you know, the hardest part for me, I think we all identify edge pass rusher as probably the top need, right? I think that's pretty commonly known. But what isn't known is, A, how much of a desire they have to trade back. B, is there going to be a pool of three or four of those seven or eight candidates that Hoffman was just talking about that are there so that it makes sense to trade back? Or do you feel like, okay, I've got to go now because a guy might not be there if, say, I drop, I don't know, 33, 34, or even 40 with New Orleans, which is a scenario that I floated the other day on the show. So I think that has made it hard for me. And then in addition to that, okay, do they decide to go running back? Do they decide to go cornerback? Do they go wide receiver? Do they go interior offensive line, which I got to be honest with you guys, I haven't spent a lot of time studying or thinking about, but now all of a sudden you're starting to hear the kid from North Dakota State and a couple of others that everybody's high on and certainly could very much be in as part of that 29 mix.
Yeah, there's so many possibilities. Let me ask both of you, what player, if that player were to drop, and I'm not talking about Abdul Carter or Travis Hunter or any of the players that are clearly at the top of this draft, but who would they not pass on? What would be their dream situation tonight with a player dropping to 29 if that's where they pick?
I mean, I'll go first here. I personally, the one that jumps out for me is Ashton Jeantzy, but I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah, that,
you discount the players that are clearly going to be gone.
Right. So I would say for me, I believe if Will Johnson from Michigan is still there, I think they have a hard time passing up. But as Craig just mentioned, Jahdae Barrett from Texas, he did fall in Jeremiah's mock draft, and I was curious about that because I've seen a lot of top 10 selections about him. I mean, if they feel the same way, obviously, and they have a top 15 grade, how do you turn that down at a neat position still for the future and somebody that can help you now, and if you had a top 15 grade? There's no way. And then it becomes even more complicated because, again, if, say, that scenario happens and you have a top 15 grade on a guy and he's there at 29, do you trade down because that's the prudent thing to do, or do you just say, you know what, we can't resist the value?
I think at that point you say you can't resist the value. The thing is, though, like, you can name any player in this draft, and I would say even including Carter, Hunter, Jeantzy, I can give you a reason why it's a bad idea. Like, that is this class. This class has five or six guys where that weaknesses list is very, very small. And obviously Carter, Jeantzy, et cetera, it's pretty small there. But I could tell you why Malachi Starks is a great idea. I could tell you why it's a bad idea. Jahdae Barron. Like, you pick your guy, Matthew Golden. I talked to someone within the last week that's like, when I saw him during the year, I thought he was a third, fourth round guy. You have other people that think he's the best receiver in this class. The valuations are so different that it's, I could tell you certainly, Will Johnson was the first name that came to mind for me as well. And I do think he could be available, which a week ago I would have told you you're on crazy pills. But I do think that there's the foot. I think there's some other stuff he didn't test at all. And to say other stuff, I think other injury stuff that concerns people. But at 29, like, what are you waiting for? Like, go do that. Shamar Stewart, Donovan Ezra, like, you name a guy, I can tell you why it's a great idea. I can tell you why it's a bad idea, which is kind of a cop-out answer, Kevin, but it is the truth about this draft class.
Yeah, the Will Johnson thing, if he's available, there are a couple of guys that, I'm sorry, but if they're available at 29, there is something drastically wrong. With him, it would be the injuries, clearly, that there's something, you know, of major concern. I think, like, you know, a Pierce or a Green, if Green were to fall to 29, then the due diligence has unveiled something about him that Washington would likely pass on to. That's just my guess. Because you're right. This draft, I would say 5 through 60, there are, you know, pluses and minuses, and everybody's got a different opinion on. I don't know if people have, at this point, a different opinion on the top two or three guys or four guys. I think Jeantzy's in that group. But anyway, what would surprise you, Craig, you first? What would shock you if they stayed at 29 and took this player?
A quarterback? Like, outside of that, I don't have an answer. Yeah, kicker, punter, we can throw those in too. Like, it's hard, man, because I have seen so and done myself. Like, I've done like 8 or 9 mocks at this point. We got another one in the 4 o'clock hour today on our show. And I've just seen too many things fall. I would say I would be kind of surprised if there's a tackle at 29, because I think that either, like, Josh Simmons' injury stuff is bad enough that you don't want him and he's available, or the good ones are going to go. I've heard Kelvin Banks, I mean, now this is out there, like, he could go as high as 6. And I've talked to people who think, like, that's deserving. I've talked to people that think he's in the teens. I've talked to people that think he's a guard and belongs in the 20s. But I think tackle would surprise me at 29, because I just don't see how the best player on their board at 29 is a tackle worth taking. That I would say that. And by the way, I think as much as a lot of people think that Brandon Coleman should be a guard, they've said he's a tackle, and I think we should believe them.
By the way, Banks is another name. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Sorry, Kev. No, I didn't mean to talk over. I'll go in general offensive line. I mentioned the guards earlier, and I agree with what Craig just said. I'll just give you one different that for me, I don't know if I would love, and it would kind of surprise me if he went this early. is Trevion Henderson. I understand what kind of breakaway speed he has. I understand they don't have that profile. I don't know, and Kevin and Craig, you would know better than me. I don't know if I see him as even a 15 to 18 carry type of guy, and I need somebody, me, moving forward beyond just not only this year, but with all four running backs being on the final year of each one of their deals, and certainly the top two having, I would say, significant injury concerns. I need somebody that can carry the ball more regularly than just being a third down and spot first and second down type guy, which is how I kind of view Trevion Henderson. That's not to say he can't play on first and second down. I just don't know if he's the bell cow, if you will. And I understand you don't want 3 yards in a cloud of dust bell cow anymore. I get it. But you guys know what I mean. Can he be asked to have the breakaway speed, the explosiveness, the pass catching ability, pass pro, and also carry the ball, say, 15 to 17 times with a bunch of those carries coming between the tackles?
Pass pro, yes, and everything else, yes. But I agree with you. I don't think he's a 20-plus carry a back game. What do you think, Craig?
Yeah, I think that he is a really, really high-end version of a piece that's really, really valuable in the NFL and specifically in this offense. But do you want a part-time starter with your first-round pick? And I would say the answer is no, especially when there is incredible depth at that position in this draft. And the other part of this that we should talk about probably more is the contract value. Like, the most expensive running back in the league is now making $15 million a year.
Yeah.
The discount you get for taking a first-round running back is not that steep compared to wide receiver, edge, quarterback, etc.
Yeah, 100%. By the way, I wanted to mention one thing real quickly because you guys who were talking about O-line would be a surprise. I don't think he'll be there, but I think if Tyler Booker dropped to 29, they would race up with that as their pick. And I've also heard in the last like 24 hours that Banks is is closing in as a close second if you consider him a guard. All right, so let's get to prediction time. I don't know if you guys have done this already on your show. I just did it. This is a bit of a reach to expect him to be available, but I went Jahdae Barron from Texas. I think the short arms, the height, there's a possibility that ends up being the reason he's available. And I don't think Ezeraku will be there at 29. And I think he would be the pick if he were there at 29. That's why I went Barron. You guys give me your pick and the logic behind it. Chris, you go first.
All right. So, I guess I'm stealing a little bit from what I did for Craig on a different feature. But I'm going to go, if he's there, of course, and I don't know if he will because of how he did at the combine and all that, Shamar Stewart. I look at him as a high upside, higher ceiling type guy, really good against the run. I think sideline to sideline, he can chase. I think backside pursuit was a strength that jumped out to me. I think he's still developing, still learning how to finish, and hopefully this coaching staff between Quinn and Joe Witt Jr. and Ryan Kerrigan and so on and so forth can figure out a way to unlock that next step, that next level. I love the athleticism, of course. We all know they love the athleticism, and I think he's a little bit underrated as a football player all around as opposed to as a rock. Who is more of a pass rusher. So I'm going to go with Shamar Stewart.
All right, Craig?
I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I agree with everything Chris Russell just said. Stewart is so underrated because people think that he's just like an athlete out there running around. It's like, no, his sack production's bad, but he does a bunch of other stuff well, which is why I think there's no shot he's going to be there the more I think about it. But if he is, I think you're right, Chris. They run to the podium and take him. And then I say there's no shot he's going to be there, so let me pick someone else. I'm going to pick a guy that has been mocked in the top 10 for most of this process, but I think Will Johnson's going to fall. And I think they would have a really hard time looking at outside corner. They know the program, obviously, with Mikey being the pick last year. His character and all that stuff is really, really high. I think he gets the Commanders tag. It's just a matter of the injury. And if he falls that far, I think you can make the argument that you go, there's a reason he's fallen this far, injuries. That's a risk. But at 29, if you're getting a top 15 talent, I think you just take that risk and you do it. So I'll go Will Johnson, the corner out of Michigan, which basically until yesterday, I would have never thought was remotely a possibility for them.
But don't you think if he fell to 20?
We didn't compare notes.
if he fell to 29, there would be it would be all about his physical health. There'd be no other reason.
Yeah, but I think you also have to. I think there's a couple factors that you have to then factor in, which is if you're a GM and a coach, you have job security. And, you know, outside of Howie Roseman, and even with Howie Roseman, the way that Lurie and the Eagles have operated sometimes, but Howie seems to be the Don there. Like, is there a coach, a GM combo with more job security in the NFL right now?
Wow. That sounds like a segment. Maybe you did it, but that's crazy to say. When you just said that, I'm like, oh my God, Adam Peters and Dan Quinn have the most job security of any team in the NFL. That's probably not true. I would think Andy Reid and the Kansas City situation has a lot of security, but
I'd say they're tied. Like them, Howie would feel like there's a tier one, and they're in it. And so if
they are now,
and especially if you take into account that this is a very patient owner, and so if you take that into account and you know you have a longer leash, I think that gives you a little bit more leeway to say, like, we're okay right now with Mikey outside, Jonathan Jones inside, and seeing what Marshawn Lattimore is and if he can regain his form. So if we need to start Will Johnson on IR, or we need to slow play him as a first round pick, at 29, we don't have as many glaring needs. We're a better team, etc. And we have that kind of leash. We're not getting fired in week four. We're not getting fired after next season. We're not getting fired in 2 years. So you have the ability to take a risk on a high-end player in a way that a lot of other teams do not because of their situation in the front office and on the coaching staff.
Look, I'd be all in, especially if they made the pick. I would trust it that they feel good about it, but God, I would be shocked if he's there at 29. The Shamar Stewart thing, I talked about this, I think, earlier this week. And I had forgotten the player that that had been described this way. Of course, he's like a physical freak, but I don't think he has any feel for football. He's a straight line athlete, and it finally occurred to me as you guys were talking about him, because Cooley used to say about Perry Riley that really athletic, the whole thing, but when the action's going in one direction, he's running the other way. I'm not saying Shamar Stewart is that, but I just don't think he has the feel of a football player, which is why the production hasn't been there. I know the pressures have been there, and maybe he can get coached up to that, but I think that's one of those things that's innate. You know, spatial feel, vision, athletic feel, he just doesn't have it when I've watched him. But physical
position,
freak, which is why I don't think he'll be there
at
29.
Position,
somebody will think that his athleticism is just too tantalizing to pass on.
Yeah, just quickly, Kevin, it's a traits position, though, and that is the position that if you just want a freak athlete at, and you're like, hey, man, see that guy with the ball right there? Go get him. And
yeah, maybe.
He's disruptive.
We'll see. He couldn't
get
him in college.
He's disruptive in the run game, too, and I think
that's
an important thing. And
he
in division
that.
With Jalen Hurts, you can chase Jalen Hurts, and that speed matters.
Thanks for this, guys. Appreciate it. Good luck the rest of the day. Yep. Have fun.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate
Craig
you.
And Chris, everybody, all day long, all night long tonight when you add in Linnell and Toby doing draft coverage. Ben Standing next.
With the 29th pick in the 2025 NFL Draft, the Washington Commanders select Josh Connerly, Jr., tackle, Oregon.
Adam Peters said last night after the pick that they had a ton of opportunities to trade back, acquire more picks, but they weren't going to accept any of those offers if Josh Connerly Jr. was on the board. And they selected him at number 29 in the first round. All of the weeks and the months of mocks and discussion, we have our answer. He is a left tackle in college, projected to be a right tackle, maybe a guard at the NFL level for Washington. Good morning, everybody. We're going to open up phone lines early here in the show. Want to get your thoughts not only on the pick, but what you'd like to see them do tonight with number 61 overall. Some of you are so interesting. I mean, I got in this morning pretty early, and I just was going through a lot of emails and notifications on Twitter just to see what the reaction was, because I didn't really stay up for it last night. I jumped on with Hoffman on his post-game show, and I, you know, for me, it was from the jump. Look, it's Adam Peters. It's an organization that's earned some trust. Let's go with it. And I'll give you more of my thoughts in a moment. But I was really surprised, I guess, at how many of you just hated it. Now, a lot of you loved it. I'm not saying this is not, you know, creating some sort of inaccurate straw man argument, but because a lot of you loved the pick. But God, there were so many of you that had a major issue with them taking just an offensive lineman. Some of you got into the details of the lineman that they took versus some of the others that were available. I'll read just a couple real quickly. This came from Mac. Mac wrote, "What are they doing? Did they see the game in Philadelphia? Defense, for God's sakes. Mike Green was the second best defensive player in the draft. Help me, please, Kevin." This from Gary. Gary wrote, he wrote UH like five times. "A left tackle? Question mark, question mark. Didn't they just trade for one of the best left tackles in the league? What am I missing?" This from Daniel PX. "They whiffed on Coleman, which forced them to trade for Tunsil, and now pick another O-lineman when they desperately needed defense. Let AP cook is becoming a punchline." All right, so before, I mean, I love the passion and the arguments that we have and the debates that we have. I'm never going to not love them because everybody's entitled to their opinion. Totally your prerogative to hate the pick. I mean, we're sports fans. That's what we do. Without a lot of information, much of the time. I'm going to give you my thoughts on the pick here shortly, but I do want to start with this, and it's for what it's worth, because I've mentioned this before when it comes to offensive linemen. For fans like me anyway, all right? I'm speaking for myself. I think it is the hardest of the positions to generate any real passion for one way or the other. You know, usually when I hear someone, you know, a fan or even somebody in my business standing on a table and screaming for a specific offensive lineman, I think it's more about someone else's analysis rather than theirs. All due respect. No offense. You know, because most of us don't have the legitimate ability, I'm saying most of us who didn't play the game or coach the game or scout the game, most of us don't have the legitimate ability to evaluate, well, any position really, let alone one as complex and often system-driven and often hidden in many ways as offensive linemen. Always hard, for me anyway, to generate sincere enthusiasm for a tackle, guard, or center. I have a friend of mine who played college football, was a starting center in college football, at the D3 level, and I trust his opinion because he's also coached for years. But that's just me. I always feel like this position is the hard one. We all feel like, even though we really don't know, we all feel like we have a pretty good, you know, beat on quarterback, running back, wide receiver, tight end, you know, pass rusher, big, you know, ugly on defense that wrecks the game, linebackers. You know, corners, I think, are very difficult positions to evaluate because it's so system-driven. It's so coached differently in every single situation. You know, of course, we can understand 40 time and subtimes and, you know, size and arm length, etc. You know, those kinds of things. But I don't know. I just think I love these conversations, and I love, you know, I love the conversations, as most of you know, about the games going into them and coming out of them. I think the draft conversation is always a tough one, but an entertaining one. And the reason it's tough is that the people that get paid to do it, like general managers in the league, are wrong 65 to 70% when they pick players. Just, you know, understand, we get all worked up every year, and it's a great television show, and it's a lot of fun. You know, but the bottom line is the guys that are getting paid millions of dollars a year to do this get it wrong 65 to 70%. And if they get it wrong only 60% of the time, they're among the elite in the game at evaluating. Now, I do think it's fair to evaluate, you know, players based on where they were taken relative to, you know, the consensus. That's fine. You know, like, did Atlanta really need to trade a future first-round pick to move up into the first round to take James Pierce? Maybe they did. Maybe that's the player they were in love with, and they realized that somebody was going to take him regardless of the red flags all over James Pierce. But, you know, the Falcons have kind of screwed things up a little bit here in recent years. You get a sense for a guy like Terry Fontenot, like, what's he doing? Like, the consensus was Pierce was going to fall out of the first round, like Green did, because of, you know, some of the intangible stuff, you know, but maybe every team was comfortable with that. That's possible too, you know, that every team was comfortable with it and they realized the player was way too good to be sitting there at, where did they take him? At 20, where was Pierce taken? 26, they traded up for Pierce. Maybe they thought, you know, a team like Baltimore or maybe Washington would take him if they didn't get up in front. I doubt Washington would have taken Pierce. But I think, you know, evaluating based on where the player was taken relative to a consensus, you know, sometimes works. But like in a draft like the one we are involved in right now, almost everybody has said, including general managers around the league, this is a draft where basically players 6 through 60 are not that different from one another. So it's kind of hard. Now, let me get to my thoughts on the pick. Because it's a position that is tough to evaluate for most of us, I totally trust in Adam Peters, and I trust in the organization. They've earned that here over a year. Like, I would say to Gary and Daniel and who was the other one, Mac, yeah, I think they did see the game in Philadelphia. It was the NFC Championship game there, Mac. They had won 14 of the 19 games they had played last year to play in the NFC Championship. And by the way, they added a lot. Now, it wasn't, you know, headline stuff in the offseason defensively, but they added a bunch of players defensively. And I would guess that they recognized that defensively they struggled at the end of last year, that they struggled to stop the run pretty much all season long, and that in the NFC title game, getting off the field was a problem. I think they probably understood that going in. I do. Like, yeah, they were there. And as far as whiffing on Coleman, again, 2 out of every 3 picks are whiffs for everybody. In the history of this thing, 2 out of every 3, basically, is a whiff. Now, if you're whiffing on 3 out of 4, if your whiff rate is 75%, you probably don't have a job. But if you're hitting, you know, on 2 out of 5 at 40%, now you're probably getting paid big bucks. It is a game, the draft, of many more misses than hits. Have they whiffed on Coleman? I don't know that they've whiffed on Coleman. Okay, he's not a left tackle, in their opinion. And maybe we learned last night he's not a right tackle. But maybe they believe he can be an outstanding guard. And if he ends up being an outstanding guard, it was a good pick. Third round. So I, number one, trust in this group because they did play in the NFC Championship game last year. You know, we got to, going into this thing, it's like you got to give this whole thing, Josh Harris, front office, new coaching staff, 3 years. I mean, they were literally at the studs of this home. They had to totally rebuild the whole thing. And real quickly, we got one hell of a big great room in the first year. All right, I trust in them, number one. Number two, the pick is a trench pick. We've talked about since the end of the season. This was part of what you thought they would emphasize in the offseason, free agency and the draft. Philadelphia is big and bad in the trenches. Oh, by the way, the other NFC East teams that they play twice a year have excellent pass rushers. Thirdly, their most prized possession, the most prized possession in the organization, is Jaden Daniels. So what did they do here in the offseason? They traded for one of the best left tackles in the game because they really felt like they needed a legitimate upgrade at that position. And they drafted in the first round a guy that will likely get an opportunity to start at right tackle. And you've got bookend tackles protecting your most prized possession. Now, if the player turns out not to be any good, because Tunsil we know is good. You know, when you trade for a player with that much, you know, wear on the tire, we've seen enough to know he's legit good. Connerly Jr., a lot of people love the pick. I didn't see the pick panned, and I was looking for expert opinion on the pick. I went and watched everything that you guys watched last night. And I will say that before the draft, even though we talked about some offensive linemen and talked about an offensive lineman being a possibility, I didn't think a guy that only played left tackle in college was going to be the selection. So I didn't spend a lot of time looking at Josh Connerly. I didn't spend a lot of time looking at offensive linemen in general. You know, so I can't tell you if Simmons would have been the better pick or they should have taken Donovan Jackson and traded up for him. Or if he had been available. Adam Peters, and I'm telling you, everything he said last year after the Jaden Daniels thing was said going into it and said after it to me from people in the know, that he was the guy right from the jump. So when he says, we got a ton of calls when we were on the clock, we got calls throughout the week, just preliminary calls like we talked about earlier in the week in our presser, and then we got a ton of calls leading up to that. And what we discussed beforehand is really, if he was on the board, we weren't going to trade back. And so there was an opportunity to trade back with a few other teams. Wasn't very far, but in our minds, it was not even worth risking missing on him. So I'm going to take him at his word. I feel like over the last year, most of what I've learned about what he said publicly has been true. And he doesn't disclose a lot. But he told you last night, we got calls. We had opportunities. We had plenty, tons of opportunities to trade back. And not even that far to trade back. Meaning, maybe they could have gotten Connerly and picked up a pick. But they didn't want to risk it. And I do think, and I've talked about this a lot, look, the more swings you get, ultimately, the better. Because if your hit rate's going to be 34, 35, 36, 37%, you'd rather have that on 10 players picked than 5 players picked. If you really, you know, if it really is the crapshoot that, you know, it tends to be every year. But I also don't like when you have a player that you really like and you think is easily the best player on your board, and you've loved him, and everybody in the organization loved him. I'll trust Adam Peters on that. You know, you risk the Ryan Kerrigan, J.J. Watt situation in 2011. You know, no offense to Ryan Kerrigan, because he was a very good NFL player and a really good player for a long time here. And now, you know, he's got a budding coaching career. But J.J. Watt's a Hall of Famer. And you traded back from 11 to 16, I think it was in that draft, or 9 to 16, and you missed out on an opportunity for a Hall of Fame player. Now, maybe they didn't have him rated in the same way they had Ryan Kerrigan. So I don't mind when they love a player and that player is best player easily on their board and they want that player, I don't mind them not trading back. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Now, the player himself, look, he's big. He is athletic, had a very good athletic, you know, relative athletic score for the position. That has been a thing, and, you know, I was looking through the RAS scores for this draft. I've looked at them already before, but I was looking to see who's left for tonight that scored very well, players that might fit, positions of need also, and there's one in particular, and I've talked about him already leading into the draft, and I'll get to that coming up here in the first hour, but This dude's big. He's athletic. He's smart. I've read, I can't tell you how many different reviews, but there was something that somebody sent me. Hoffman mentioned this to me last night. It's called The Beast. It's the guy from The Athletic. Sorry, I'm blanking on his name. Dane Brugler. Dane Brugler writes something called The Beast. Anyway, he does an extensive write-up, and Hoffman was talking to me about it last night. I was unfamiliar with it. So I looked up Connerly, and he's got a lot of good, you know, a lot of information. And this sort of runs parallel with a lot of the other information, but I liked a lot of this. And by the way, in watching some of the highlights, this dude really is athletic. Like, he can really move. And when a guy can really move, you understand why they would want him in the Kingsbury scheme. They need their offensive lineman to be able to get out, you know, on bubbles, on screens, quick game, etc. By the way, did you see what Adam Peters held up? He had a piece of paper that he showed everybody. It was from Cliff Kingsbury. He left a note on Adam Peters' desk. I guess it was yesterday. Please, the Oregon tackle. Kingsbury apparently loved Connerly Jr. You know, a couple of things about Connerly stood out in this write-up from Brugler and others. Obviously, this is a big man, you know, with good arm length. Not the longest arm length, but really solid arm length. And then very, very quick in the immediate line of scrimmage, you know, plus 10 area. Scored very well. The RAS score, very good for the position. And the write-up was outstanding lateral quicks, change of direction, and overall movement skills. Explosive jump setter to easily cut off pass rush angles. Elite recovery balance. Average height, he's 6'4 and a half, close to 6'5. But above average arm length and big hands. You know, the above average arm length, and maybe this has gotten to the in recent years, gotten to an area where it's not as applicable because we've seen some shorter arm, very good tackles in the game. But remember when Brandon Scherff was selected? You know, pretty much Jay Gruden and everybody in that organization knew that he was a guard, not a tackle, because he had shorter arms. You'd rather have longer arms as a tackle. You know, you put those arms on somebody. By the way, it can help with respect to lack of quickness. But anyway, keeps a head on a swivel to locate blitzes and stunts. Light feet and body control to seal front side on zone reads. It goes on and on, but really what it speaks to is athleticism. He's very athletic. He may not be overpowering, but he is right now very athletic, and they want athletes. And with the quick stuff that they run, with the get it out of his hands on bubbles, on screens, that's what you're looking for. He finished his career at Oregon, 28 straight starts, did not miss a start basically in two seasons. And he allowed only six pressures over his final 12 starts, all of those coming against Ohio State. More on that when we start looking at second round. Did well against Abdul Carter. Remember, Oregon, for those of you that may have forgotten, was in the Big Ten this year. So I like the pick. This is another investment in Jaden. And there's one other thing to just think about, you know, looking ahead. And I think that this was something, when I brought up offensive line as a possibility, this is what I was speaking to in most cases. You probably are going to be moving on from Wiley and from Allegretti. Remember, the investment in Allegretti in particular was, at the time, we didn't even know if he'd be a starter for sure. But he did. He started and he was fine. But what this, to me, says is it's Tunsil at left tackle, of course. By the way, Tunsil being an older player, maybe the long-term solution is Connerly Jr. at left tackle when Tunsil gets older, but he plays the first part of his career at right tackle. But I think what we'll see is we'll see Tunsil. We will see Allegretti probably to start. Biotish, because Cosmi's out with the ACL, at least for the first portion of the year, That's where you see Coleman, and then you see Connerly Jr. at right tackle. That would be my guess. Now, if Connerly Jr. is not ready for right tackle, Coleman can play right tackle. He could play inside. When Cosmi comes back, that's where I think ultimately you end up with an offensive line that is Tunsil, Coleman, Biotish, Cosmi, and Connerly Jr. Whether that's at some point this year or that's in 2026. You can't go wrong if you trust the evaluators, and so far there's no reason to not trust the evaluators, in the division they're in and the team that they most have to beat out, investing in the offensive line to protect your quarterback, and by the way, potentially to run the ball better. Remember what happened towards the last quarter, last third of the season? We couldn't run the football unless it was the quarterback running. That, by the way, is a part of what they were probably paying attention to also. You know, we talked a lot about why aren't the running backs gaining more yards? Well, is it the runners? Is it the O-line? Is it in their read option game? Is it maybe the quarterback not making the right decisions? Is it play calling? Is it scheme? Who knows? But I think what they've told you is, we want to get better at running the football, and by the way, we want to get better and more consistent protecting our most prized possession. I have no problem with this pick. I have no idea if it'll work out. None. I don't have a strong feel on the player like I do at other positions, but I totally, totally am fine with the pick, and there's just no chance you could get me to like pan the pick just because I wasn't expecting it. And just because guys like Mike Green were still on the board. I loved Mike Green watching him. I thought he was the second best edge behind Abdul Carter in the draft. But his issues at UVA and in high school, and who knows what else, clearly Mike Green was the guy that fell along with Will Johnson because of injuries, the corner from Michigan. So, you know, I said going into this, there are a couple of players I don't think they'll take. And Pierce Jr.'s work ethic red flags were a big issue, but I thought that Green, in part, wouldn't even be an option for them because I thought somebody would end up taking him. He's available. Will Johnson, because of injuries, available. That's interesting to me. I mean, yesterday on the show, I forget, Max, was it Chris or Craig who picked Will Johnson to be the pick for Washington? Craig's been falling.
Craig was banging that drum most of the day. Yeah.
So Craig said he's falling, and he that was his pick, and I'm like, if he falls to 29, there's got to be a major, major problem, and I don't see Washington taking that, but he was right that he dropped, and a lot of mock drafts had him dropping leading up to yesterday. There's a lot that they had on the board. They had Azaraku as a pass rusher. He didn't get picked in the first round. They had Green. They had a couple of the corners available, and they had a player in mind. And maybe if Connerly Jr. had gone before, maybe they would have accepted one of those trade backs. We wouldn't have gotten a pick, and we would have had a couple to get excited about tonight. But there are a lot of opportunities tonight. I can't wait to see what they decide to do. I think, you know, in terms of at 61, there are going to be running backs. There are going to be corners. There's still going to potentially be edges available. There's one player, and I've talked about him, that I really kind of fell in love with that was more projected late on night two and in some cases even day three. But he had the third best relative athletic score of all of the players that were tested for that, and he would fill a need. I would bet that Washington is interested in Darian Porter from Iowa State. I don't know if 61's too early, but Darian Porter had the third best relative athletic score, RAS score, And he is an outstanding, big, long, physically imposing corner who also has been a phenomenal special teams player. And he ran the, in addition to having the third best RAS score, he ran the third best 40 time. 6'3", long arms, can play zone, can play man. That's a guy that I would look at if he's on the board at 61 for tonight, just based on what they've been looking for. You know, we know the character. The dude plays special teams. He didn't start for many years, got his first opportunity this year, but he's off the charts athletic, off the charts tall, long, and, you know, seems to be, they went with a high RAS score for an offensive lineman last night, a real athletic lineman. I would look in that general direction tonight. There are other players, too, in other positions that had high scores that are available tonight as well. But I pointed out Porter because that was the one where he jumps off when you watch highlights from a fan perspective, for sure, because he is an outlier size-wise, athlete-wise, and just aggressiveness-wise. I mean, the dude blocked four punts and a field goal in college. All right. Let's give you a chance. 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980. Your thoughts on Josh Connerly Jr. There are a couple of things I want to play for you when we come back. Adam, some of what Adam Peters said, and a longtime NFL player and NFL coach who I've always enjoyed his thoughts. He weighed in on Josh Connerly. You'll hear that as well. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app.